Kirsten Powers.
I have a question for you, and I'm just going to follow up on what you were talking about. I think that I don't know that it is that people are just raging against the CEOs. I think, at least from my perspective, I always feel like if someone's making 300% more, why aren't they, and much more than they would have been in the past, right? So they could still be living a wonderful life at a fraction of what they're making. I'm always wondering why there isn't some sort of social pressure on them to take that money and reinvest it into their workers versus taking it as compensation. And I'm wondering if you think that's illegitimate. Because I know I say that, and a lot of Republicans say that's illegitimate. I don't have a right to say that. They can do whatever they want with their money. And I say, well, of course, they can do whatever they want with their money, but there seems to be something wrong if you're laying off people and then taking that money. And is that a fair moral judgment to make, or is that out of bounds?
There's nothing wrong with making a moral judgment about what people should do with their money. You know, if the idea that, I mean, it's legal for somebody to take their money and spend it on lottery tickets or booze. That's legal. Is it moral? You decide if you've got kids, if you're harming your family by doing that. We make moral judgments all the time about what we spend our money on and what we invest our money in. The most frequent expression of our values are our economic and consumption decisions, in point of fact. There's nothing wrong whatsoever with applying moral suasion. Now, quick point. We in the free enterprise movement love to quote The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, 1776, important year in American history too. But we forget that Adam Smith's most important book was written 17 years earlier. It was The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And it was the book that he went back to after The Wealth of Nations and worked on for the rest of his life. That moral sentiments were more important than market mechanisms. In point of fact, morals must come before markets. We can say anything we want as a society. If we believe that it's illegitimate to use something, but it's legal. Again, you know, you and I have talked about this. The interesting part of life is the gray zone between legitimacy and prohibition. There are lots of things that are not prohibited, but they're not right. And that's our job as decent individuals, as people who care about each other, to set the moral rules of the road. I mean, there are all kinds of examples of this. We talked about marriage just a second ago. It's a very interesting facet of public opinion that the big majority of people believe that adultery should be legal. And the equal percentage of people, 95%, believe that adultery is bad. Majority of people believe that prostitution should be illegal, but a smaller percentage think it's indecent than those who think that adultery is wrong. If you absorb those statistics, I didn't present them very artfully just now, but you get the picture. People believe that certain things should be legal but aren't right, other things that aren't right but that should be legal. We have a responsibility as decent people to set up the moral rules of the road. Adam Smith would have told us that, because if we don't do that, our markets are not going to work in the first place. And guess what? That's what's happening.
That's what people are doing when they're criticizing economic inequality versus just raging at CEOs, I guess is my point. My question for you is, you've mentioned a couple times now that there needs to be some sort of, I don't know, peace made between people who, some sort of respect for religious institutions that are in opposition to same-sex marriage, who serve the poor. It seems to me that I don't have a lot of hope that that's going to happen. It seems to be moving in the direction of people saying that they shouldn't be receiving government funds or even receiving funding from private foundations. Are you more hopeful? Do you see that there's a way to make peace? And if so, how can that peace be made?
I think just one comment on the compensation thing. Arthur said, and I hope I've been clear about my admiration for Arthur and his leadership in his movement, his party, and our country, said the reason why the minimum wage is a problem is it prices some people out and they would lose work. My sense, I've only served on one board that had a lot of very highly paid executives. It's a closed system. The people who decide what they're worth are all people who have the same job, and they think they're worth everything. So it's not self-regulating, it's self-perpetuating. And so people who make a gazillion dollars say people who do work like me also ought to make a gazillion dollars, and that's one area where the market is not self-regulating. I think same-sex marriage is the biggest problem. I think abortion is a more fundamental problem. I'll speak for myself. When you believe something involves the destruction of innocent human life, I don't think you can expect a Catholic hospital or a Catholic charity or an evangelical storefront, homeless shelter, to be a part of that. And I would hope that we would find a way, and I think progressives, frankly, have to step up on this, to say that there are some areas of life where we're going to agree to disagree, and that people contribute to the common good, even if they have a different view of this, and they shouldn't be required to participate in this. We've had a robust set of conscience protections until now. Part of it is, can the winners in the gay marriage debate win graciously? Or are they going to have to insist that everybody sign up right away exactly to what they believe, or the contribution they're making to the larger society can no longer be sustained? As I said earlier, I don't know who's going to shelter the homeless. I don't know who's going to run the food kitchens. If it doesn't include people whose faith requires them to do that, and in some cases that same faith says they can't be a part of abortion, for example.
Over here.
Jumping off of that point, and this is a question for both of you. For you, John, in terms of the religious, moral, theological imperative, for you in terms of government versus free enterprise, the U.S., I mean, this has become a topic of discussion again. The U.S. has some of the worst family leave policies, unregulated child care that's also very expensive, where kids are often in danger. So for you, the question is, to what extent is the onus on government to fix that, to create policies so that women can go to work and feel needed as something other than mothers and breastfeeders? And to what extent can the Catholic Church get behind contraception or things that keep women off the road to abortion so that they can, you know, stay in school or stay in a job, or if they do have a kid, things that are implement policies that are truly pro-life past the 9 months of gestation?
Go ahead, John.
Please don't take this badly. I think the Catholic Church is not restricted to the 9 months of gestation. I think the religious community generally, and the Catholic Church specifically, does more than almost any other institution for women and children, not only in this country, but around the world. I don't think you're going to see a formal change on the church's teaching on contraception. It's not the kind of thing that the church has insisted be a part of public law. Candidly, it is a lot easier to get contraception than it is a lot of other medical services in this country. It's now free. The only question left is how directly involved religious institutions have to be. So I don't think the policy, the teaching is going to change, at least in the foreseeable future. I don't see how that becomes a stumbling block for participation in care for the poor and vulnerable.
The way that the church, gets involved in issues of same-sex marriage or abortion or contraception, why not push for family-friendly policies? Why not lobby for those, for example, in the U.S., for giving women longer maternal leave or universal pre-K or preschool that's well-regulated and safe?
I actually have good news on this one. The Catholic Church does lobby on those things. One of the great achievements of my modest advocacy career was helping to persuade Henry Hyde, big pro-life Republican, to support family and medical leave and bring with him a number of pro-life Republicans. And I think Mr. Hyde, who's passed, would say that it was his church and his pro-life convictions. The church is strongly on record for paid family and maternity leave. Probably that's a prudential judgment that Arthur wouldn't agree with. It's one where Pope Francis has been speaking up on. I think you, part of it is, you know, the bishops are meeting in Baltimore. Every story out of that meeting will, almost every story will have something about sex in it. The work of the conference on poverty issues, on family issues, on foreign aid issues doesn't get much attention.
Sex does have a lot to do with it. You mentioned a child who was born to a mother that's married, who has finished high school, who has waited to have kids till she's, I mean, that is, sex is very much connected to poverty.
My daughter works in Baltimore. She was went to Loyola College. I now work in a Jesuit institution. Before I went to Georgetown, the only experience I had with Jesuit education was paying for it, and it cost a lot. She got in to Teach for America. She works in an inner city Baltimore school. You can imagine what the last year has been like. And she is not a big supporter of the church's teaching on contraception. She does not think the kids in her school that have babies are doing so because they don't have contraception. She thinks they're having them because they want to have babies. And they think a baby will love them. And there aren't many people in their life who love them. And that almost no one's surprised when they get pregnant. So there are bigger things at work. I think in inner city Baltimore, you can get contraception. What you maybe can't get is someone to love you.
Arthur, you want to comment?
Yeah, just briefly.
Tom, you're next.
I think John covered a lot of what I think. I don't have an objection to a lot of these smaller adjustments to policy around family leave. I don't have big objections to that. I don't think that this is a policy design issue on what's actually going to make it easiest to work and what's going to make compensation the highest for people at the bottom of the income distribution. I would object to the idea when you say just mothers and breastfeeders. Particularly the Catholic Church, nobody has been better about the celebration of the critical importance to humanity. Pope John Paul II referred to motherhood as trusteeship of humanity. And so when we say that, I think that we betray ideals, we betray values that are not just inconsistent with the Catholic Church, but they're inconsistent with what we need to be as a society. Now, and you don't mean that, of course, but I think that that's something that we have to be really careful about when we talk in general about public policy. When it comes to raising wages, however, I think that there are some really good and I think should be uncontroversial ways to raise wages that I've talked about before for both men and women, such that men and women are earning more as opposed to creating disincentives at the firm level. Again, this is pretty basic economics, and I don't want these things to be true. I don't want low-wage retail and food service to lay people off because their wages have to go up by law. But I do know in point of fact, I'm an economist. I talk to people all the time that are on the edge, that have 1.5% and 2% profit margins, that say when the lowest wage workers, when the wages go up, they're going to keep kids like my teenage kids. They're going to lay people off that have dropped out of high school, or people who don't speak English. And these are the people at the periphery of society that we most want to help. So having policies that don't do that, either through family leave policies or through minimum wage increases, but rather we can get their wages up through something like the earned income tax credit, which would immediately make it easier for people to support themselves and their families, that we can hit many of the same objectives while not destroying the jobs for people that we can't see, the most transparent members of our society that we're worried about the most.
Asked about creating policies, using government policy to free women up to work, to feel necessary in the same way that men would like to feel necessary and needed outside the home in a professional context, be it as an exterminator or as a white-collar lawyer. Policies like daycare that's either subsidized, subsidized, regulated, safe, so that, you know, when you drop your kids off on your way to your factory job or your legal job, you know that your kid's not going to die. There was a public, loud case recently of a woman in publishing who was forced to go back to work after 3 months, and her son died within hours of his first day at daycare.
I don't know the right answer to that. And part of it is because I can imagine the debate that I'd have internally at AEI.
between people who actually understand exactly what you said and share those sentiments and people who would talk about the result that we've seen actually in the social democratic countries of Western Europe, which they see relatively low wages, very high levels of workforce expectation, falling fertility, and they wonder how it's all related in general equilibrium. So as sort of the cosmic level, I don't know what the right thing to do is, but I certainly don't have a natural negative reaction to anything that you suggest.
Tom, you're next. Over here.
This should be brief. Arthur, I just wanted you to respond to actually a point that John made, which was, John, your emphasis on "and," which I took as an endorsement of sort of pragmatic approaches that combine different techniques or different strategies. Arthur, you said that people living in starvation at starvation levels have declined by 80% since 1970, and you gave essentially an ideological explanation for that involves emulation of the American enterprise model. But my understanding is that no government during that time has lifted more people out of poverty than China. And China is hardly a good example of the American enterprise model, whether you're talking about rule of law, whether you're talking about property rights, whether you're talking about free trade. And you sort of discounted central planning, which is actually a pretty important part of the Chinese model. So I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, isn't it a little bit hard to defend this highly ideological explanation for prosperity?
Thanks. And I'll start by saying, I just have never seen your face before. I just heard your voice my whole life. and I just love your work on the radio. I listen to you all the time. I'm a big fan. But you know, I think that the points that I made were actually economic and not ideological on their face. And so let's talk about the case of China, which seems to be a refutation of the American free enterprise model, and see how that fits. It's not been since 1980, since 1970, it's been since 1982 that 680 million Chinese have been pulled out of starvation level poverty. 500 million of those have been pulled out of actual poverty. Okay, so you've gone from starvation levels to poverty and above poverty. It's a rather extraordinary achievement. So then the question is, what's the deal? You know, what's the deal? Is that a refutation of what I said, or is it somehow fit? The reason is, and you said, okay, property rights are weak in China, to be sure. Religious freedom is a disaster in China. Free trade actually is the answer to what happened, because after 1982, but the point, he said it's because of currency manipulation, but the point is that China, for the first time after 1982, started wanting overtly to trade with the rest of the world. That was key. So it was globalization and free trade, which are the first two economic. I don't mean them to sound just ideological, because it's not rah, rah, rah. The reason I love the free enterprise system is because of those things. It's not that I come up with those things because I love the free enterprise system, because actually I have a real religion, unlike, you know, just capitalism, I think. I mean, I try not to be biased under those circumstances, so I say that with as much honesty as I can. But it was globalization and free trade. And here's another great irony to submit to you for your consideration, and you may disagree, but I think it's worth considering nonetheless, that it was, for the very first time, free and peaceful sea lanes across the Pacific after World War II that facilitated that globalization and free trade between China and the West, largely between China and the United States, and that was adjudicated by the American military. So it was American military leadership that somewhat paradoxically has pulled hundreds of millions, at least indirectly, hundreds of millions of citizens of our brothers and sisters out of poverty among our greatest geopolitical adversary. The ironies of this are really interesting, but the human welfare really comes along. Now, what I'm suggesting, however, is this, Tom. If there were greater property rights and rule of law, along with the entrepreneurship, free trade, and globalization, China could have done a lot better. Now, why should you object to my argument? Because I just made it on the basis of a counterfactual, which is a very weak basis for argumentation, and I can't. It's a non-testable hypothesis, but that is my view. Thank you.
John, you had a quick comment on this.
Quick comment. You both know more about China than I do, but I know if we had a group of journalists and others getting together to talk about faith and public life, and somebody would go to jail. I would hope it'd be Michael. Just a quick comment on, it is not pragmatism that leads me to go for the "and," it's reality. A child's future is very much influenced by the choices of her parents and the policies of her government. And I think we know that from experience. We certainly know that if you work with the poor, it is not. It also happens to be politically more viable in this environment, and it happens to make policy sense. But it's reality that suggests you have to work on both parts of this.
Robert Draper and then Lauren Green.
Yeah, I have a. I wanted to return to the basic question of whether we as a society should care about poverty. John Yoo rejected on its face the claim made by some in the political sector that we all agree poverty is a terrible problem. We just happen to disagree on some of the solutions, and pointed out correctly that. In the last two debates, the subject did not make so much as a cameo appearance. Now, Arthur, you, I think, if I'm representing this correctly, that you had said the argument that you make, and I respect that you make an argument on the subject at all, is that we should care about lifting up the poor because without that, there's no salvation for us. It's an argument essentially of enlightened self-interest. And it strikes me as well that the argument we also ought to be making is that we should care about the poor because they are unfortunate replicas of ourselves, that there but for the grace of God go we, and that we should therefore see the poor as us rather than as parasites, rather than as victims of their own character defects. That is an argument for teaching empathy. How do we do that, particularly in a political climate that has become an empathy-killing field?
That's a question. Thank you for that. Let me put even more of a point on that. I mean, the theological argument that the poor are necessary for our salvation is one that some of you share and some of you don't. I'm not going to assume that all of you are believing Christians. But my point was that our nation was built on the poor, and that's not just enlightened self-interest either. That is this understanding of American unity. Now, the greatest thing about the Pope, and maybe some I've written about this subject personally, the greatest thing about this Pope is that his sense of supernatural unity that says that you, that Robert is Arthur, that we are each other, that we're made, that we are part of God, and that the poor are not like us. They are us. We are the poor. Now, in an intergenerational sense, that's actually quite correct. I can go back in one or two or three generations in every single one of your families and find somebody who's poor. And in other words, it's just a few years apart from where we are, which is meaningless in any human sense of this. So given the fact that we are the poor, we're lifting ourselves up when we lift them up, and in this case of empathy. How do you inspire more empathy? Okay, case study in public policy. Let's get back to the issue that you talk about with John, which is marriage equality. How did the marriage equality movement actually turn around? 15 years ago, it was a 70-30 issue against, and every major Democratic politician, including Bill and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, were against it. Now it's 60-44 in just 15 years. How did they do it? They stopped fighting against bourgeois morality and started fighting for equal civil rights for law-abiding citizens. In other words, they relied on empathy by saying, we are them and they are us. They're just like us. That's how it actually works. And how did they do it? By showing the faces. Basically, it was the gay rights movement saying, we want to be boring suburbanites too. We want to get married too. We want to do all the stuff. We want to have a dog and a station wagon too. It was an incredible thing. It's a seismic cultural shift of moving against this notion of bourgeois morality being outdated and ridiculous to saying, we want it too. We have the right to being boring, right? Okay, so let's consider that here for a second. If there's a cosmic unity between us and the poor because we really are the poor, how do you help people to understand that? By showing their faces. Now, I can sort of do it as a think tank president. Who has the power to do it? You do. You're the journalist. You show people faces. You talk about their lives. To a certain extent, when you humanize them. See, when I read everything about poverty, because it's the thing I care about the most. When I read about poverty in the newspaper, when I watch something about poverty on television, when I listen to something about poverty on the radio, it's about them, right? It's always about them. It's never about us. It never humanizes them and talks about their actual lives. See, we have these lives, you know, with our kids and, you know, their jobs and all that. Poor people, they're all, we talk about them as homo economicus. We talk about what they don't have. Have you ever noticed that? So what if you show me their face and talk about them the same way that you'd talk about me? If you did a portrait of them in the same way that you would talk a portrait of me, then suddenly we can understand that they are me, and that's the basis of empathy, is comparison and similarity. The basis of empathy is not difference and deprivation. It's similarity. And that's where I think where it really starts, and you have the power to change that.
Just
okay, John. And then Lauren, and we're actually going to have to stop at 3:15, so I know a lot of people are on the list still.
Well, really quickly then, one of the, before it gets to any policy, any priority, Pope Francis talks about encounter. And he's very specific. He says some people like to engage behind a screen that they can turn on and turn off. He talks about couch potato Catholics, which I resent terribly. If he talks about recliner Catholics, I'm really going to be upset. His foundation is that as human beings, we belong to each other. The other thing he says is the moral test of our nation is how we treat the poorest among us. So it's personal, and then it's a question of moral priority.
Okay, Lauren Green.
I'm feeding off of everything that, Carl and Kirsten and Robert talked about, basically, because I wanted to go back to this idea of that we need the poor. And the one thing that struck me about that phrase with you is that sometimes that is being, you got to be careful with the language you use or that we use when we talk about things like that, because it could be used as the same sort of tool of oppression, the same way that slavery was used. You know, the Bible's phrase about slavery, you know, slaves be kind to your or obey your masters, that sort of thing. You see, understand that this is a tool that some people use as saying, well, see, the poor will always be with us, so I don't have to adjust my thinking. And the reason why I thought that is because my niece, and this is a real person, my niece, who worked for a franchise apparel store, I'm not even going to say what it was because I don't have all the facts right here in front of me, but about 6 or 7 years ago, she worked there, and she made about $8.50 an hour around that time. But they would not allow her to work over 35 hours a week because if she did, they'd have to pay health insurance. And so even though she was living on her own, paying her own rent, she could not even get to be working 40 hours or close to it, or else she would be penalized for it. The same time, the owner of this particular company, I think he sold to a corporation, built a $100 million house someplace. Now, how do you convince someone like that of the moral imperative to look after workers? You know, I'm not particularly, you know, liberal or whatever, but I just thought on a humanistic, made in the image of God level, that's got to be wrong. How do you convince people to have a different kind of understanding of what it means to be taking care of the poor or just giving people a leg up?
Hmm. 5 minutes to do
that's
it.
That's, I mean, you're asking for a lesson on persuasion. I mean, because that's what we're really talking about, because I don't ask, you're not suggesting that what we need is to reach into the pocket of the guy with a $100 million house and take his house away somehow and do that. I mean, that's a different, maybe that's something that you would suggest, but that's not what you're saying. You're talking about how do you convince him that that's the wrong thing to do? Well, that's the subject of Bob Putnam and Charles Murray's books. See, this is really the interesting thing, and he talks about the shift in our culture that happened from the 1950s until today, and a lot of good things happened from the 1950s to today, and the civil rights movement happened from the 1950s to today, but one of the things that really happened that was deleterious to our society, that really ripped us apart,
which is why Charles Murray's book is called Coming Apart, is that we stopped knowing people, we stopped being around other people. This is actually related to Robert's question. It's a question of the empathy that we will have with other people. If we lived together in the same society, if you had people that you were limiting their hours to 35 a week and you were paying them seven and a quarter an hour, you're paying them the minimum wage, you're unlikely to build a $100 million house. And he talks about, Charles Murray talks about growing up in Newton, Iowa, from a middle-class family down, who lived three blocks away from the president of Maytag, and the guy drove a Buick. Why? Because it would be unseemly for him to build this massive mansion. When we have social dislocation that's such that we segregate ourselves according to class, this is what necessarily happens. And so when it comes to persuasion, what we need to be thinking about is being together more. What do we do to be together more? At the public policy level, by the way, some of the most compelling public policies that I've seen, they take public housing, they don't crowd poor people into large complexes all together. We take poor people and we mix them in public housing into middle class and upper middle class communities. Why? Because then people see the faces of the poor, and the poor see aspirationally what it means to not be poor, and that's really critical. And then you're unlikely. Look, if you're living next door to a bunch of poor people, how many cars are you going to buy? If you're a decent person, maybe a lot, maybe not so many. And so this is really the critical thing to do. What can we do to change our culture to remember that we have a responsibility to be together, that all of us are in this thing together? And I think that's the direction that I would take this, because that's what would foment empathy. I'm not worried about the guy's $100 million house. I'm worried about the guy wanting to build a $100 million house. In a very real way, because that is not just bad. It actually doesn't hurt poor people at all that he does that. It's the attachment and the separateness, the attachment to the material things, the tyranny of that, and the separateness which increases the haves and have nots in our society that creates the big problem. So I don't have the cultural answer to that, but I think that's the path that we have to go down.
I'll simply add that my wife and I decided not to build a $100 million house.
That's bigger than mine.
We have to wrap up in a few minutes, and so I know John wants to make some final comments. We're going to have free time between 3:15 or 3:20 till 6. We have reception. Where we had breakfast and lunch is where we're going to have dinner tonight. So there'll be an hour reception from 6 to 7, and then dinner at 7. So it's right out here. I think that's the announcements I need to make, right, Sylvia? We'll be right out here. John, you give us your final words, and then we're going to thank both of you for your terrific work.
I was really struck by the last part of this conversation about how faces and knowing people matter. And I wanted to give an illustration of this idea of the and the different institutions. A lot of people around the table know my brother David, who was a columnist for the New York Times and who passed away earlier this year. What you may not know is David's history. David was a drug addict. He was on the streets. He had two little girls with his dealer. And if you think about how David went from the streets to the New York Times to a great dad, it involved a ferocious family who never gave up on him. It involved a church and an AA community, those non-public institutions. It involved employers from local weeklies to the New York Times that gave him a shot, even though he had a record. And the government paid for treatment over and over, paid for foster care for his little girls. And he, part of this book or this story. But my point is, if you took away any part of that, the family that supported him, He when he got out of treatment, he had these two little girls, and he went to the local parish, knocked on the door, and he said, "I've been a bad son, brother, husband, person, worker. I don't want to be a bad father. These little girls ought to be baptized." And the pastor could have said, "We have a program for this. Come back in the morning." The pastor said, "Welcome home." So lots of places. Different institutions, different people stood up. And when David passed, which is very sad, he left behind a wonderful family, lots of friends, had made a real contribution. But he was poor. And these institutions stepped up, and he stepped up. And one of the lessons of Pope Francis is never give up on anybody. And that's an example of where never giving up made a difference.